Okay, good morning, everybody. It's October 26th, Hillary Clinton's birthday, if you didn't know. It is also my birthday, that's right. And I'm two times I use plus 10, if that helps. Okay. So today is the 17th lecture. We are way past the halfway point. It's the last lecture before the midterm on Wednesday, but you already knew that. It's actually a pretty good lecture to have before the midterm because even though it's a different kind of topic, a lot of the themes of this lecture will cut across the previous lectures about metadata and different kinds of classification systems and so on. So it's actually a little bit of a refresher and review. And what are you doing in the class today? Oh, you're spying. I get it. Oh, sorry. Okay. All right, so we're going to talk about metadata for multimedia, and in particular, we're going to talk about how multimedia metadata is different from, but similar to, the challenges raised by metadata for more traditional bibliographic material. If you look in Spinonius, you'll be maybe not surprised that the word multimedia does not appear in that book. She's more of a traditional kind of metadata person. We'll talk about professional metadata, and we'll use as an example the work from the Getty Museum and the Getty Vocabularies and Architecture Thesaurus. We'll talk about various kinds of amateur metadata, and finally we'll talk about contextual metadata of the type that was in the Moore Nauman paper about using context to enhance the description of photographs. So what is multimedia? I mean, we can define it lots of different ways. We can define it, just think in terms of the media types. Well, if there's more than one of these, it must be multi, right? So if it's text plus something else, it could be multimedia. Text plus audio, which could be speech, music, or sound, graphics, images, moving images, video of various types. Or we could have it be, rather than the kind of composition, would be more intrinsically multimedia, where we have essentially a time-based media format. And that's really one of the defining differences between multimedia and non-text media, and that you have this temporal dimension that's running alongside it. But even though multimedia is different in many ways from text bibliographic entities, boy, I love that phrase. I just love what that sounds, bibliographic entity. Anyway, things that can be described, essentially, right? If you look at the question we would ask, and I've shown you this set of questions many times because it's really an important list of questions. About what the defining question about multimedia. What is getting metadata assigned to it? What is the granularity of the thing we're trying to assign metadata to? What specific elements or descriptors or attributes or properties are we trying to assign values to that instance? What format is the metadata being recorded in? Are there standards, and if there are, which standards are there for the meta model or the control vocabulary? Meta model meaning a standard for a type of information that we want to have consistent metadata for. So it's really something which is really describing at the level of the type. And then a control vocabulary, which was often we think more about that, saying what is the vocabulary assigned to an instance. And then finally, who is assigning the metadata, and who could be either a person or it could be some agent, computational process. And the question there, of course, are, can that assigner actually conform to the rules that we think we've defined in terms of the standards for the meta model control vocabulary? So it's quite a question of competence, as can it do this? But then there's also a question of, you might say, trust or intent, which is that can you count on that agent or person doing that? I mean, can you you believe that the metadata is reliable in the sense that it is it being done in a consistent, accurate way. And that's why there's been some interesting concerns about the Google Book Search, where the processes by assigning metadata seem to be somewhat, less than first-rate and competent in many cases. We've seen those stories by Jeff Numberg and others about that. One thing about, describing, this is something we've talked about a lot this semester. What does it mean to describe something? And again, this is a far more subtle than it might seem at first glance, because we have to primarily start by saying, what is it exactly we're trying to describe? The scoping issue, as you've seen in many of your assignments. What is the range of things I'm trying to consider? Is it just some fixed set? Or I'm going to just try to describe all the possible instances in some set? How large is that set? And so on. We want to study the instances, the actual or potential instances, to identify what the pertinent properties or features would be. And again, we're making choices there about which of those properties we choose to emphasize, because in doing so, we introduce bias. Which things are we going to focus on? Which means which things we're not going to focus on when we assign descriptors to our bibliographic entities, the things being described. We do this in order to compare the things we're describing and essentially make distinctions about things which are like something and things which are unlike it. And in doing so, we are basically building a system of categories, a system of description which will imply that some instances are good examples and some of them are not so good examples. They're outside that boundary. They don't conform to that model. And then finally, we have to create those descriptions. And that may be done by observation or maybe done by more sophisticated techniques, measurement of various kinds of properties. We could say, what is the specific gravity of this chemical? What's the temperature? All kinds of things we might want to actually measure and then associate that with the object, again, either by hand or by some automated process. So again, it's maybe I'm beating this to death, but I mean, I've been going over all semester about this, the complexity of these seemingly trivial ideas about putting names on things and describing things, and because I want you to really appreciate the difficulty, the conceptual foundations of these activities, which you do all the time, but which you probably didn't think much about until you walked into the 202 land. One thing that makes multimedia different is that we have a whole new set of concepts about the things being described, and it's really quite amazing how much we have that. I mean, I just made a quick list last year to say what are the kinds of things we're trying to describe, and we realize we have a lot more. I mean, we talked in the bibliographic universe about things like the abstraction hierarchy of the work, you know, between, well, there's four levels there, and, you know, they have some relationships to each other, and, you know, but we're, maybe they're all the same kind of thing, and then they get a little bit broader and so on. But if we look at what we have in multimedia, we have a much broader set of things to talk about. I made up some examples here. We have playlists, albums, cues. We have composite, collage, mixing, remixing, and there's maybe subtle differences here. Clips, samples, bytes. We could describe something about the history of a particular kind of item or manifestation in terms of is it the original or is it a remake or is it a cover version? I particularly was intrigued by the number of things that can be put in front of cast. We have broadcasting, narrowcasting, simulcasting, telecasting, webcasting, podcasting. These are all new concepts, really, in fairly recent time. And then for more complex kind of multimedia, I have things like installations or environments. So again, there's a much richer set of things that we would want to describe than in the normal kind of text bibliographic universe. And again, that's part of the complexity about multimedia description. There's just a broader range of things that we're trying to describe than we have in the more traditional bibliographic sphere. But there's some three things about multimedia that are really almost the fundamental differences between describing text objects and non-text objects. And they are the sensory gap, the semantic gap, and the proliferation problem. And let me just go through those one at a time. The sensory gap is, well, here's a sensory gap. Here you have a number of different depictions of the same thing, and they're radically different. I mean, they have we can recognize this as being the campanile, but that's almost magical. We can do that because there's a huge gap between the object and the description we're going to. When we say that's the campanile, there's a huge gap there between the sort of sensory representation of that object and us being able to give a label or a name to it. And that is profound when it comes to a machine trying to do it. What's interesting is that while there's an infinite number of signals that could be produced by the same object, depending on things like the lighting conditions or the distance orientation, things like that, and you can have the same thing produce, different things can produce the same signals as you often see in things like optical illusions, right? Where you see the same thing from different points of view and it looks like two objects are the same when they're actually different objects. But people are able to solve this. That's a vocabulary problem, right? They're able to solve this vocabulary problem at the sensory level because we have enormously complex and interesting, you know, conceptual and sensory machinery to bridge that gap between the different stimuli that are impinging on our retina or our auditory cortex or all sorts of other ways of experiencing these non-text objects. But for computers, as Shimon Ullman, who's one of the world's experts on computational vision, says, the best systems are like three-year-olds. I mean, they're surpassed by three-year-olds. A three-year-old is better at recognizing objects than computers are. So computers can only recognize objects in fairly constrained things. So you put an object on an assembly line, and you'll have some machine vision trying to figure out which ones are maybe defective or something. They'll look for defects on the surface or something. But they're not able to do, you know, vision in the large at all, with any kind of accuracy. But we can solve it very easily as people. So that's part of what makes this interesting challenge. It looks pretty obvious for us, which is why we can put names on things easily. But our names, again, will be subject to the vocabulary problem. So while we can cross the sensory vocabulary problem, we have then the more cognitive vocabulary problem left over. Machines can't do either. They can describe it at the sensory level, but they can't... Yeah?
What about facial recognition software?
That's probably a special case where the amount of money that's been invested in that is staggering. I mean, if I spent $1 billion on something, I probably could solve it too. I mean, again, it's facial. I should look something up about that. Good question. Again, my off-the-cuff answer is yeah. That's a special case. We put so much money in that you know. But I think it's different. I think also that the descriptor space for faces is smaller than you might think. There's probably half a dozen features which can identify a face as opposed to what will identify some scene in the large. All right, so that's the first gap, the sensory gap, which is that there's a very large number of representations that sensory representation which can be created by the same object. So how to identify it is a very non-trivial problem. Now the semantic gap is the fact that when we have instruments, devices, sensors, you know, cameras, you know, camcorders, any other kind of instrument that measures some sensory data, captures it, it's then encoded in a format which is optimized for the machine doing its work, for capturing it and decoding it and so on. And that means that the representation that the machine has is likely to be one which is optimized for it and not for you as a human reader. So the source format that the machine captures is going to be semantically opaque. That's a phrase you see a lot of in this literature about the opacity of the representation because you can't look at it and tell anything about it. So again, there's another gap, which is the gap between the descriptions that machines apply to objects and the ones that people would apply to the same objects. So again, that's why we have to have metadata, because that is something that people can perceive, even though the actual representation of the object itself isn't really perceptible or understandable. So if I say, what's this picture about? This actually is a picture I took off my computer and I looked at it, the format, and well, there it is. Well, what is it? You know, it's, you can't look at this representation of the file format and make any judgment at all about what this might be, even though, of course, when I shove this to the picture reader, it knows exactly, it can represent it perfectly. It has captured exactly the representation that it needs to reproduce the original scene. Likewise, you can name this tune. Again, this is a recording. It's the same kind of problem that while we have, you know, my recorder's done just a perfectly fine job of this, and it can replay this, it's replaying it on its own terms and not in a level of representation that is amenable to you making any sense out of this. Now, it's not that there's not a semantic gap for text, but it's essentially smaller, because while there may be... Yeah?
You could say the same thing without a key looking at a score or a symphony.
That is correct. Yeah, there are different levels of description of these kinds of things, and again, if you don't understand the description, you can't make sense of it. Right? Just that for text... While, of course, there are opaque text formats, if I look at a PDF file of a document, I can't necessarily read it. But there will be levels of description of text files which are much more amenable, like this one here, which is the lecture from a few years ago. I mean, I can actually look at this and I can extract directly the same things that the machine is storing in XML about the lecture. So the gap is smaller for text than it is for video or audio or other kinds of multimedia. So that's the second problem, the semantic gap problem. The third problem is the problem of proliferation. And, I mean, it's probably not surprising to you now to think about it, but far more camera phones are sold worldwide than digital cameras. And digital cameras or camera phones are the computer for 90% of the world. And so... And in fact, in most cases, that camera is now becoming, or that phone-camera combination is becoming a programmable multimedia capture and presentation platform of various kinds. And so, if you think about this as sort of the inevitable result of advances in technology, you see that we now have the ability to capture a very large amount of multimedia, pictures, video, whatever kinds, sounds of various kinds, in a way which was unimaginable a couple decades ago. I recall my first tape recorder was this monstrous thing with the big reels of tape and everything. It wasn't portable in any way, right? Camera was a major deal, like a picture. You take it and get the picture developed. You know, you took a very smaller picture because they were so expensive. You didn't have the kind of ability to just capture thousands of photographs. And so it's possible now for ordinary folks to have very large collections of multimedia objects. In fact, they're so large that they get us into that trade-off again about... think about the average value of a photo you take now as it was, say, to someone like Ansel Adams. Okay? Ansel Adams would get his camera, sit there, and he'd wait for 6 hours to take that one picture. Right? Because he wanted to make that one picture. Right? It was actually expensive to take a picture, so you wouldn't want to waste your plates and stuff, right? I mean, even 20 years ago, sending your film, or 10 years ago probably, even sending off your film to get developed, it was still, you made decisions about when to take pictures, how to pose things, how to wait for the right moment. Now you just slap, slap, slap away and you don't even think about it, because the average cost of the average value and cost of each object is so much smaller. Now, of course, that changes the trade-off a lot. You say, well, I can all take another one. Okay? And so, if you think in terms of the incentive structure, you now say, well, I don't have any reason to invest as much in the metadata of a photo. And so many of our photos, if you look at I'm sure that I have a gazillion photos called, 3724.jpg on my computer, right? Because I haven't bothered to go around and put any metadata on them. There just isn't any, I'll get to it. It's not like I have this precious collection of 7 photos I want to store. The irony, of course, is that if you don't take the effort or don't have the techniques or technology that will let you efficiently store and manage, with metadata capturing and use of all this proliferation of media instances, you lose a lot of the advantage of it. What good is it to have a terabyte full of photos if you never can find any of them, right? And so, if you look at what people are doing, I think there's an awful lot of innovation in this area, but a lot of it is kind of lame in terms of trying to attack the core problems of that we've just talked about. The technology approaches by themselves, you know, are just capturing more and more information. But again, if we don't have ways to make that effective in your personal information management, it doesn't really get you very far. I mean, how many of you use, Flickr? Some more than others now, right? Okay. How many of you use YouTube? Right? Are there other things besides those two? There's many, many. If you look right now in your favorite search engine, like Microsoft Bing or Google, or whatever it is, you'll find, and you type in photo organizer or video organizer, you'll find just dozens of these programs. Which to me says that people aren't happy with everything else. They haven't found the one that works for them yet. So there's a lot of innovation in this area. Does anyone have one they particularly like that they're just passionate about? Yeah. What? We like Flickr. It's the best. Does anyone have an opinion besides that Flickr's the best about photos? Jess?
Well, what about
Vimeo,
actually?
Vimeo? The quality is better. In what way?
The actual quality of the
file. So you're able to store higher resolution video on Vimeo than you are on YouTube.
When you play them, they look much better.
So they look better. Okay. So why does Vimeo have higher quality than YouTube?
What?
Why does it have higher quality? Okay.
It's also much prettier. It's
prettier. Okay. Creative Commons is what?
Embedded
in Vimeo? And not on YouTube. For shame on YouTube. So they have they're better able to capture and exploit Creative Commons metadata on Vimeo. So this is the end of YouTube as we know it, Creative Commons tagging? No, you don't think so. Why isn't that metadata important to people?
Yeah, not enough though.
Not enough importance to enough people.
YouTube is about the big audience and
doing 90%
of the users
want. So I'm just curious. Let me just so we have YouTube, we have Vimeo. Anything else?
Flip TV?
Blip.tv. I love those two Albaloolians that made this deal. That was so smart. You know about this, right? That this little island in the middle of the South Pacific, which is basically a dung pile for bats, that, you know, not much else besides that, they sold the right to their domain name for $50 million. So people can have .tv domain names. Yeah.
Right.
If you wanted to organize a private collection of video, what would you use? Any of you have a large collection of video? How about photos? How do you organize your photos? You use Flickr for photos?
I use web services, but I use software.
And what do you use?
Lightroom.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually prompts you for, it asks for metadata tagging right when you open it, when you import photos.
Okay.
That's more for professional
photographers, right? Picasa. So again, there are a lot of them. It would be a useful exercise to have to compare a couple of these. Why don't you make a note of that on our social media platform, so we won't forget it for next year. I can put it in the lecture next year, point to it directly. I mean, that's one thing. I hope next year to be able to have the benefit of all your blogging and tagging, and I can go back and change lectures and be more, you know, cutting edge of all the cool stuff you guys find. You know. Okay. All right. Well, so the question is, so we have these three gaps. We have the semantic gap, the sensory gap, and the proliferation problem. The real question is, are they new problems? And, you know, some of them are probably new, but not all of them are new. If you think about the problem of museums, and many of you are interested in museums, I mean, the Think of what a museum has. A museum may have many artifacts that represent the same work. Right? And that's kind of like the sensory gap. There's a lot of things they could describe, but there's, you know, many possible descriptions for them. The things that the museums have, say a piece of sculpture, let's say, or some kind of physical medium, the materials that the medium in which the artifact is embodied will not necessarily have semantics on their surface. I mean, there may be an author who may have signed the work, but maybe there won't be any identification of the work. And just there's the work, and there's no metadata at all on it. You've got to somehow discover how to describe it. And of course, there may be many artifacts of a particular type. If you think about a museum like the Hearst Museum here on the campus. Have you been to the Hearst Museum? Have you been to the museum here on campus? The Anthropology Museum? It's a great collection, but about 99% of it is invisible. It's not being shown. They have warehouses all over the Bay Area of stuff. Probably must have been around early part of the 20th century. There were huge expeditions, a lot of Berkeley professors around the world collecting stuff and bringing it back by the container ship load, although they didn't have container ships then, but you know what the point is. They just stuffed them in warehouses all over the Bay Area. Very little of it is visible to people. And museums have been around a long time. The oldest continuously operating museum in the world is the Ashmolean, which was founded in 1680. Anyone been to the Ashmolean? Cool museum. 1683. We were living in caves in this country, and they had a museum in Oxford. Tell us something about the relative maturity of the civilizations. So the question is it a matter of degree? And so if I look at these two metamedia multimedia artifacts, I mean, they both have some of these same problems of the semantic and sensory gaps. I mean, this is actually one of my favorite recordings I made a long time ago. I didn't make the one on the left. That was made by somebody about 2,000 years ago. But again, there's descriptions, and there's not very much of it on the surface. I mean, I had to apply that metadata to that thing because nothing was being born in the surface or in the actual object itself. And again, it's called unknown because you know, there's nobody made a note there attached to it, to the leg of this horse saying, I'm you know, John Brown, and I'm a carver, and I made this horse, and it's 550 B.C., He wouldn't be able to say 550 B.C., obviously, because it would be B.C. would kind of be the wrong point of view, right? So he didn't know it was going to be C, right? So, but you get the idea that you know, in some sense, it's just a matter of how much, right? So how much you know about an object. Now, I think there are some new problems, and the problems primarily the ones that have to do with the temporality of video and audio, where there's... You need a different descriptive vocabulary. You just don't have the same lexicon when you're talking about bibliographic entities of the Svenonian type when you look at sound and video. And in particular, you have this emotional dimension. I mean, it's hard. I mean, while I often retrieve bibliographic work to satisfy emotional as well as information requirements, I don't often listen to music to satisfy information requirements. Okay, so there clearly is a need for somewhat more evaluative or interpretive dimensions on non-text media, because that's often the context in which people come to retrieve them. Okay, so let's look at what kind of metadata we would apply to multimedia non-text works. I mean, this is not a new problem. We've done this in museums for hundreds of years, trying to describe things. And there's very sophisticated classification rules in these contexts. And in particular, there's a kind of hierarchy where we layer different sets of descriptors to have those which are accessible to lay people, kind of untutored users of these artifacts, to those which are progressively more layered on. So this is at the core of the question about you know, what kind of metadata different people are able to provide. If we've talked a bit about examples where some museums are letting people go and tag you know, assign descriptors to the object in the collection, and they're likely to assign very different kinds of descriptors than an art historian would assign to them. But again, those that an art historian assigns them may be not as accessible to the person who comes into the museum on an occasional basis. So, you know, you need both kinds of descriptors, and what we need are systematic levels of description. So one reason why I assigned you the Getty paper was because that's a really nice description of the classical framework of art historians about levels of description. How many of you have studied any art history or theory of art or that kind of stuff? Anybody? Oh, good. All right. So have you read Studies in Iconology, George?
Iconology?
Studies of the Panofsky book? Now, did you ever study Panofsky?
No.
Really? In my one art history course, I studied Panofsky. All right. Anybody study Panofsky? All right. So in this paper, there was a description of Panofsky's three levels of meaning, which is what I learned when I studied art history back about 1930 when he was living. Maybe because he was a contemporary. That's why. But he was an important figure in the sort of the theory of art. And he was a sort of a public intellectual at the time. He hung out with guys like Einstein and stuff at the same time in the 30s. And he wrote a book that's called Studies in Iconology, among others, that introduced this notion of levels of description and or levels of meaning. And he distinguished three ways of looking at a work to assign descriptions to it. And he distinguished the primary or natural level, which he calls the description level, from the identification level, from the interpretation level. And I'm going to go through these one at a time because I think it's a useful way of thinking about layers or levels of description that I think is actually really pretty cool. So again, the example that I learned the example was the art, The Last Supper, which is a very famous painting that many of you have probably seen pictures of. If you haven't seen it, I think it's in Milan, actually. Is it in Milan? Yeah.
It's actually really small.
Yeah, it's not a big picture, but it's in Milan, in some little out-of-the-way church someplace. But, you know, The Last Supper, at the level of, well, what's it about? Well, there's 13 guys having dinner. Right? Having some kind of dinner feast of some kind. And yet, of course, it's much more meaningful than that. But that's the level that if you didn't know nothing about nothing, you could walk in there and say, oh, picture 13 guys having dinner. Right? And that's sort of the point, is that there's this level at which even a person with no knowledge of the prior knowledge of the painting or the domain or anything could say that's a description of that painting. And so this level of description is sort of this, what are the generic things that are in the being depicted or in or on the object? You say, well, it's a horse. It's a sculpture of a horse, right? Or it's a picture of 10 guys or 12, 13 guys having dinner or something like that. So again, anybody could walk in there and make that tag. And that, that is either the reason why it's such a powerful thing to have that democracy of tagging, that anybody would be able to presumably tag that and understand that level of description. Or you could say it's sort of the mundane, uninformed, sort of illiterate view of the object. Okay? And so we want to have other layers of description which would provide more information that would be, might require some effort to create. So we have the next level is that of identification, which is, you know, some more precise or normative description of the subject or thing being depicted in the work. So you say, oh, there's these 13 guys in this painting, and their names are Jesus, John, you know, Paul, Judas, and so on, right? The twelve apostles of Jesus Christ in the painting. Okay, so this is now like the facts, where instead of just being, oh, there's a couple of guys around the table. No, you say, well, there's the names of these guys. Okay, and by the way, the painting was painted by, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, that kind of thing, and it's painted in 1493 or whatever it was painted. Okay, so again, these are the facts, And they might require some research or, you know, investigation from other sources than the one that's directly in front of it, which is why you wouldn't expect anybody walking up to the picture to be able to know it or to apply that level of description. Because how would they know the names of the guys? It's not painted on, they're not labeled on the painting. Okay. And finally, there's this level which is called, what does it all mean level, which is the interpretive level, where it's what, it's like the purpose or symbolism depicted in the work. What is this thing about? And that will be deeply embodied in the culture and context in which the work was created. And this may require deep, deep analysis and thinking by people who have spent their lives in some particular area of work to be able to understand the relationship of this work to other works and things like that. So, let's do an example in some detail, because the example in the paper was actually a wonderful example like this. It raises all sorts of nice issues. And it's also a very pretty picture. So that's why this is the picture that is described in the Getty paper. But of course, you don't know this, because of course, it's just a picture. At the first level, there is no description. It's just a picture. So we don't even know who wrote it, what the title is. So now we're going to go back to the descriptive levels. That's why I've hidden the metadata at the top of the slide. Okay? So you are somebody who's never seen this painting before, and you said, now tag it. Okay? You're going to be the descriptive level of metadata for this picture. What do you say? Let's describe it. Again, be careful that, remember, you're not, at this level, you don't use anything you know about this picture. You don't let any interpretation sneak in. This is like, what do you see here? What do you see in this picture? You'd say, what would you say? Give me a tag for this picture.
People.
Well, there's people. That's really good. Anything else for these people? Can you see any of the people? There's a mother holding, well, there's a woman holding a baby. I don't know that you know it's a mother. Can you tell us the mother? Woman holding child. Okay. What's going on here?
Blank stare.
Well, blank stares? Yeah.
They're all staring at the baby.
They're staring at the baby? Okay. It was that they're staring at the baby. Who was staring at the baby?
Everyone.
But in particular, who was in the picture? There's four guys. So there's four men, a woman, and a baby. We'd call this picture four men, a woman, and a baby. Right? What else?
Is it like a priest or something?
A priest.
Yeah, given some holy water.
Well, okay. They're holding things. The three of the guys are holding things. Right? Anything else you might want to distinguish about this picture? You could describe. I can see something about, well, the dudes, the three dudes are on the right, one guy's on the left. Perhaps the guy on the left is associated with the woman, and the three guys are together, perhaps, right?
Three of the guys have hats on.
Three of the guys have hats on. Oh, don't that. Okay, yeah.
Well, the three on the left have halos, and the three on the right seem to be offering something.
The three on the left have halos. Good note, good pickup. So they got halos on. Three people with halos, which means they're probably collectively about something there. And the other three guys don't have halos, but they have things in their hands. So three guys with nothing on, with no halos have things in their hands. The other three people are there kind of meeting them, perhaps, right? Okay.
Would you classify the style of the painting, not the content, but the style as being Renaissance?
I don't know what Renaissance means. I just walked into the painting for the first time in my life. It could be painted last week, as far as I know. It could be a copy of a Renaissance painting.
Sure.
Okay, so that's description. Okay, now, let's try to identify it. So who are the people in the picture? What are their names?
Well, I think it's the three kings.
It's the three kings, the three wise men. What are their names?
Yeah.
100% correct identification. You're an art student. With that, you're a very devout person.
I'm very devout.
Okay. The three wise men are Melchior, Balthazar, and Caspar. And they're the three wise men. And who are the other people? Who are these people? What are their names?
Joseph,
Mary, and Jesus. That's good. That's good. That's important cultural stuff to know that, at least. Okay. This is a famous New Testament Bible story. You know that, right? Written about in Matthew 2. This is all identification. These are just facts. This is a story of the three wise men coming to visit the baby Jesus and give gifts. What are the gifts? We can find that in the Old Testament. And that's identification. We know they're giving them three gifts. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Okay, so we know that's all the facts. Okay, now, suppose you are a deep-thinking art historian wondering about the symbolism of this painting. What do we know?
This is your way to temporal, secular world, recognizing the serenity of the new spiritual realm, the spiritual leadership.
And they're bringing gifts. What kind of gifts are they bringing, and what do the gifts represent? It's very deep, because in this painting, you have three men of different ages, and they're bringing gifts which are characteristics of different times in a person's life cycle, or lifetime. So you have a young guy, a middle-aged guy, and an old guy, and they're bringing gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which reflect Christ's role as king, divinity, and then in death. These are characteristic things at different points in your lifetime. And so the overall journey of the Magi represents the conversion to Christianity of the world. Kind of the collision of the secular world and the Christian world here. Okay? Now, just as in the description we talked about a few weeks ago about the abstracted hierarchy of the work, the boundaries are not entirely clear all the time between identification and interpretation. We could say this is a painting by Andrea Mantegna, and it was painted around 1495-ish to 1500-ish or so. Okay, and that would be probably factual, but of course, suppose you were a Leonardo file. He said, well, you know, I happen to know that this painting by Leonardo da Vinci called Adoration of the Magi, same title as the other one, okay, was painted in 1492, I think, or is it even earlier, 1482, by Leonardo da Vinci, same subject matter, same characters, okay. Leonardo was already pretty famous in 1490. Perhaps Mantegna is trying to free ride on Leonardo by copying one of his paintings. Okay? Now, you could argue from the facts that, well, that's possible, but of course, the speculation is where you start getting interpretive. So again, the lines are not entirely clear, and the interpretation would be from a particular point of view, trying to discredit Mantegna or somehow pump up Leonardo and so on. I think that Mantegna's picture is better. But the point is that the lines are not clear, right? So, but there clearly is a difference in the level between these three: description, identification, and interpretation. Exactly where the lines are drawn might be subject to some debate. Now we can put the label back on, because you passed that descriptive test. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the Getty vocabularies. This is a wonderful, wonderful resource for the world. We can thank the IRS for this, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. Because J. Paul Getty, who was a gazillionaire in the oil business, you might have heard of Getty Oil at some point, okay, left many billions of dollars to a foundation called the Getty Foundation. And they had his art collection. They built this incredible palace and museum in Los Angeles in the hills. Have any of you been to the Getty Museum? It's a pretty staggering museum. The grounds themselves probably cost $1 billion to make. I mean, the kind of sculptures and fountains in the grounds and stuff, let alone the museum. But in fact, they weren't spending the money fast enough. The IRS requires a foundation to spend 5% of its assets every year or else lose its tax status. And Getty wasn't spending enough money. So they started had to hire lots of people to spend the money. And part of what they did, it's now like the Full Employment Act for art professors and historians. And they just hired tons of people to like develop stuff for art because they couldn't spend the money fast. Maybe there's a little jaundiced view of it, but it's definitely the case that Getty cranked up the spending machine when the IRS said you're not spending money fast enough. So a lot of what you saw, like the book you read, that's a chapter from a book that was written by a bunch of art professors who were hired by Getty to write about stuff, okay, and help develop these kinds of resources. And in particular, the AAT is just a staggering work. It's like the psyche of art and kind of that kind of effort. 133,000 terms, descriptions, and citations that are organized to help people attach metadata to art in a systematic way. There also are other resources like authority file for artist names. Like we saw the authority file in the Library of Congress, it's an authority file for artist names. We also have a gazetteer, kind of a thesaurus of geographic names useful in describing the locations at which things took place. Let me show you some examples of that. So here you see from the AAT, the entrance about Carrara marble. This is the marble that was used by Michelangelo was used by the Romans 2,000 years ago. It was used by Michelangelo and still used today. You go to Carrara, Italy, it's in the hills about an hour north of Pisa and Florence along the Italian coast. And the mountains are white. They look like chalk. And they jokingly say, we're down to our last 100 cubic kilometers of marble, so we got to be careful. It's only going to last another 10,000 years or something. You know, they're carving the mountains up and making marble out of it, and it's just the whole mountains are white. Unbelievable. And it's this pure Carrara marble, the whitest marble in the world. And it's, of course, very valuable in sculpture. So here you see the entrance in the Getty AAT about Carrara marble. See that it has a number of different names attached to it. And you see a ontology in which you see where the description Carrara marble fits in a hierarchy of other kinds of things. So obviously it's a kind of material. It's a kind of inorganic material, a rock. It's a metamorphic rock, a type of marble that's white and so on. So this is this kind of description would be really useful because you could then, for example, search for I shouldn't answer this question. You should be able to answer this question. You know? How would having descriptors arranged in a known ontology like this be able to do more effective organization and retrieval? Well, that's emphasized with the student. You didn't have to answer it now. You can answer it on Wednesday. Yeah.
You could search for all sculptures made with that kind of marble, or you could search for all sculptures by a certain artist made with that marble.
Or say, I'm looking for marble. I don't know the name of it. I know it's a kind of marble. I'll look for white marble, and then I'll kind of up and down the ontology to find the name of that I really want to search for. Yeah. That's right. What that kind of white marble would be. Okay? So again, you can see how this could be built into a search engine to provide suggestions for you, help you sort of navigate the set of possible answers. If you have too many answers, let's find a refined term. I'm looking for white marble. There's too many things. Let's go look for what's a more refined kind of white marble, Carrara marble, so on. Let's see. We mentioned this guy. You know, Michelangelo was one of the people who used Carrara marble. This guy has had a lot of names, and not all of which are used by him. Some of them are used by people who try to write about him. But there's an enormous number of variants of this guy's name in the universe of information about art. So fortunately, we have a preferred term in which everything is tied to. So if you misspelled it in ways like Michelangelo, you know, it will hook you up with the authoritative version of the name and let you use that as the entry point into the collection. We also have this thesaurus of geographic names, which again is a thesaurus of places. It's often called the gazetteer. And again, this is a way to help you, again, navigate more effectively in a collection, because you know that Carrara is a place in the province of Massa Carrara, which is the Tuscany region of Italy, part of Europe and the world, and so on. You know that it's an inhabited place, which has been inhabited for a very long time, and so on. So this is a way to, if you have that word Carrara, you can then find out more about things related to Carrara, because you have this auxiliary index structure behind the scenes. So again, this is an enormous amount of work that went into the Getty AAT and these other resources. And I said it's because they had to spend the money somehow, and they decided to spend it on what I view as a pretty socially useful purpose. Okay. I also had you read the paper by Marty Hurst and some of her students. This is, I guess, about 5 years old. Marty Hurst, by the way, is, as most of you probably know, is not going to be around this year or next year, it looks like, unfortunately. She's on leave from Berkeley, and she's working for the Obama administration at the GSA, the General Services Administration, doing something probably like this, I would imagine, to help the government organize itself a little bit better. There's plenty of opportunity for that. But it's sort of a loss, because she really has a distinctive competency in user interfaces for search and computational linguistics and so on. By the way, her book is out. I have a copy of it now. If you haven't, if you like the chapters you're reading in that book, it's out. All right. So this is an effort of a few years ago that Marty did with some students to figure out ways to build on top of metadata to provide enhanced user experiences. And what they did was very, very clever. They took something called WordNet. Now, WordNet was a research project, I'd say about 1,000th as ambitious as Psyche was to build an ontology, but it was a particularly narrow one. It was basically an ontology of word and concepts done by Department of Cognitive Science at Princeton under George Miller, mostly in the 80s and 90s. It has been commercialized as a product called the Visual Thesaurus, which many of you have seen, which uses this underlying network of semantic relationships and lexical relationships to visually depict the meaning of words. So if I see something like marble, and I look it up in the thesaurus, look it up and say, do you want to pay for this? You want to get a free version? I think I'm going to get the free version. Okay, so here you see marble, and it shows that there marble is related to sculpture, but it's also related to rock and stone. It's also related to ball, and I can move around here, and now focus on sculpture and sort of move into that part of the word net space. Sculpture is related to carving. It's also related to graves. Graves. There's the sculpts. Okay, we get the idea. So there's sort of this network of words and the relationships, and I can use this to do interesting things. And in particular, what Marty Hurst did was use, when you have a description you obtain from one source, you can go into WordNet and say, what is this word connected to? And use that as a way to enhance the metadata of the original source. All right, so this kind of it's a way to find synonyms and, you know, maybe other words that would be, think about when you designed your FASTA classification system, you say, what words are useful descriptors for things on this dimension? We can go into WordNet and find them, because what are the associated things with it, right? The properties of that thing. And so they used WordNet as the primary knowledge base to extract facets using the text descriptions of I believe the Hearst Museum. All right, and this is was one of a number of projects which was done at the iSchool. You're going to read about one a little bit later this semester, the Delphi project, which was a master's project done by Patrick Schmidt and a number of other students in the iSchool about 2007 and 8. So see, it says fall. Here's fall 2007. Kind of, okay. A group of I students were doing this project and they used NLP to build a toolkit for doing things like this. So in fact, many of you are interested in museums. The Delphi project has built a toolkit that you can use for like processing descriptions to identify things like facets. Patrick Schmidt works on campus at a group called Semantic Services, which is doing a lot of work to provide this kind of technology for the whole museums of the University of California system. It's quite an interesting project. Okay. So what this flamenco project has done is taken from the text of descriptions of the records in the museums here and tried to figure out, using WordNet hierarchy, what are the facets that are sort of the parents in the ontology. And here you see the media, nature, location, date, people, and so on. These are obviously things which are going to be remember hypo, hypers, and all that stuff? You forgot that already? Okay. They're the ones on top of the words that you got. Which one is that? Hypernym. Okay, good. Just make sure. These are the hypernyms that we've extracted. And you see how it's going to be break up what was a blob space of descriptions into a very rich, faceted experience. And I can search for objects in the collection that match the values on these particular facets. And so you see, here you see a catalog item where we're using, again, the writer would display the item using the metadata now to organize the presentation of the item. So what we're doing is this completely model-driven experience where we extract the facets and then we build the page using the facets that we extracted when we processed the collection. So there may be different pages based on which metadata was extracted from those objects. Pretty cool stuff. And those of you who are interested in museums, put that stuff in Delphi and this kind of work. Okay. Talk a bit about amateur multimedia metadata as we contrast to what we just saw was a very much professional and augmented professional metadata. Flickr, YouTube, and so on, as you are now seeing as you look at these kinds of tagging sites, are characterized by non-standard classification schemes. You can invent any tags you like, and that's either the good thing or the bad thing, the ease with which you can assign descriptors to things. But there's no professional metadata to start with when you go to Flickr. It's usually just, here's my pictures. And so you have, as a result, you have no control vocabularies and little standardization, except with the exception, as we saw last week with the reading by Thomas Schluchta about the German beetles. Remember we read the one where the beetle was tagged with the scientific classification? That is the way you pronounce your name, right? I got that right? Close?
Close enough.
Close enough, okay. With the beetles that had the scientific classification, the beetles and the GPS coordinates, and where we found this, we have these more controlled vocabularies mixing with the uncontrolled vocabulary, but as a rule, it's more uncontrolled than controlled in that place. As a result, you'll have extremely idiosyncratic metadata to organize a collection that an individual will have. So we talked last time about personal information management. Personal information management for multimedia has the same kind of properties as it does for texting, which is that it means it's going to be fairly biased and idiosyncratic. So think about how you organize the songs on your iPods or other music carriers, players, or how you organize your record collection. You have record collections, some of you, right? Well, 3 years ago, some of you may know him, Matt Earp, who was a master's student here, class 2008, was my TA in 2007, was a professional disc jockey. I guess he still is. He performs under the name Kid Chameleon. That helps anybody know who he is. Anyway, so Matt has to organize his collection according to the properties that are most relevant to a DJ. So that's not name artist, that's beats per minute. Okay, so here's his hip-hop collection at home, and he sorts them based on how the beat per minute. Because that's really the important attribute. So that you wouldn't have necessarily thought that that's the most important piece of metadata about a record, the number of beats per minute in it. But it is to a to a DJ in this particular case. So again, the it's an individual collection. And even those who are trying to do institutional collection of metadata, institutional metadata for non-text objects will have problems. So if we look at, this is a couple years ago, I went to Amazon, Blockbuster, Netflix and said, how do they organize movies? Okay? I mean, while there is some overlap, there is quite a lot of differences. So, I mean, Amazon has some categories that the other ones don't have. They have Art House and International, which is not in the other ones. We have Kids and Family, and Family and Kids. That's an interesting flip-off. And then you see... get the idea. They have an anime and manga category they don't have in the other ones and so on. So again, these are the institutional categories, and they're different. I can look at podcasts. There's a number of podcast directors on the web. Here's iTunes classification of podcasts. I could find other categories done by other providers that are very different. It's not surprising. They're complex types of multimedia, and it's quite clear that they're not going to be the same for everybody. So this brings us to the last reading of the today, which is the paper about contextual metadata. This is a quote from some of your hero, David Weinberger, who talks about why we shouldn't bother. Manual metadata is just too hard. You know, we have too much stuff here. As a result, we do a bad job of it. So a lot of us have pictures that might as well be called don't know, don't care .jpg. Because we didn't bother to put any metadata on them at all. And so his view is, hey, why bother? Because you won't do a good job of it anyway, and you're too lazy, and there's no good institutional scheme, so whatever. Okay? Now, the argument he's made, and the argument that Cory Doctorow made for the same reason, was that as well we should rely on contextual metadata. Contextual metadata is metadata that is available at the moment the media was captured, the content was captured, because it's inherent in the context. Most people think obviously about location, time, or other things or people that were present when we captured the content, but there are many, many more. What kind of things could we capture besides those three? Very, very large number. I want you to think about that. We'll talk about that in a bit, but there's an enormous number of potential context elements that we could capture. And we'll talk about that when we get to the paper about the photographs, where they explicitly try to capture some of that. I think they still have a long way to go. But this is not a new idea either. You go to the Ashmolean Museum, as I talked about, and you look for some of their archaeological artifacts. And here you see information about the time and location of capture. In fact, if any halfway competent archaeologist will go to a site and be very meticulous about what things were found next to other things, because that will have a lot to say about what the objects were for, because people will often have activity-centered organization. Remember that? You know? The blacksmith, how he put the tools that he used to do things together. So you go to the dig up the Egyptians, and you'll find things next to them that have common purpose. So again, that where they were found, which corner of the excavation and what thing they were next to was very important data to capture in these kinds of activities. Now we can capture more stuff automatically. We take a picture. There's an enormous amount of data that is goes along for the ride. This is called the EXIF file, which is associated with all the photographs on your digital cameras. This is really useful if you want to do sophisticated processing of your photos, but of course, even here, you see things like the date and time was taken. This could be, of course, automatically fixed by time zone. Yes?
I was thinking of a smaller version of this would be if most of your photos are taken for mobile uploads. Facebook or Twitter, that usually asks for a caption. It has a
often.
Right.
This is the party.
So in fact, Mark Davis, who used to be an assistant professor at the iSchool, now works for Yahoo Research as their chief metadata scientist, or multimedia scientist or something, had a research project involving students capturing, taking pictures around the campus and having to tag them. In fact, he taught 202 before I did, along with Ray Larson, the two of them taught together. And he spent a good part of his part of the semester where students did all their homework assignments, which are basically applying metadata and developing ontologies for photos and things like that. So it was like his research project was embodied in 202, for better or worse. There were 7 lectures on photo metadata that year. And part of what he was developing was techniques and applications for using context to improve tagging. So they had an application which ran on your smartphone that I think was called MMM, that would look around and look for the Bluetooth signatures of other phones and figure out who you were with, if you were within a group, and then you could have, if you, they were in your social network, it would send pictures to them and things like that. So you could have an automatic photo sharing based on the context that was being embodied in the iPhone application, not the phone application. That brings it to the paper by Nauman et al., where they've done, again, very much the same kind of faceted classification scheme that you saw in the Marty Hirst paper, but in this case, this facet are being extracted from contextual metadata, which is either available at the moment that the photo was taken or afterwards. And that's the key thing, that once you have a kind of primary key, let's say, namely, probably which would be the time and the location that the picture was taken. If you know the time and location, the photograph, you know an awful lot of other stuff, and that's the key to this particular effort. So, what they've done here essentially was.